reading the minutes. For Thursday, June 14th, to order. We have a few things on the agenda today. First, we've got, I would entertain a motion to approve those minutes that from the September. Representative Zellers has moved to approve the minutes that are in the packets from the September 20th meeting. Any discussion to that? Seeing none on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion does prevail. Next on the agenda, there is a consideration of a motion. I would entertain a motion to have that resolution put in front of us.
So moved.
Representative Zellers has moved the resolution regarding relating to legal counsel. It is available in members' packets, and I believe it will be available to the public. Is there discussion to that resolution? Oh, it's LCC. It's labeled LCC number one. But I believe it is in the packet.
Are we going to get Madam Chair? Are we going to get a presentation?
If you would like one, Representative
Tiesa. I would like one. Yes.
Who of the staff would like to address legal counsel from the Senate, Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair and members, I can give you a little bit of background on the nature of the litigation that has been commenced in the Supreme Court. There have been a number of media accounts, but it may be useful to review it briefly here. A variety of interest groups and individuals filed a petition in the Supreme Court on May 30th. Those groups included the League of Women Voters Minnesota, Common Cause, Jewish Community Action, and a number of named individuals. And among the attorneys representing them is counsel from the American Civil Liberties Union. This is a statutory proceeding filed under Minnesota Statute Section 204B.44, which is also known as the Errors and Omissions Statute. And essentially what the petition does is allege that the ballot question presented and passed by the legislature for the photo ID constitutional amendment contains a variety of errors and omissions. What is somewhat unique about this is that the statute allows any individual to commence the proceeding directly in the Supreme Court in this instance because it's a statewide question, and there's a very compressed time frame. Included in your packets is a copy of the court's scheduling order. A couple of the dates that I would highlight for you, and some of them have already passed. There was a deadline for motions to intervene on June 8th, and as you know, the legislature has filed a motion to intervene. The court hasn't ruled on motions to intervene yet. There is a briefing deadline for June 25th, and a hearing is set for July 17th. This, as I said, will be taken up directly by the Supreme Court and decided presumably very promptly after the July 17th hearing. As I said, it's a limited proceeding. It goes simply to the nature of the ballot question. Petitioners have presented a number of arguments in support of their claims that the question contains a variety of errors and omissions. And in effect, the basic claim is the question is misleading because they believe that it could mislead a voter of common intelligence as to the meaning and effect of the amendment. There are a variety of specific claims. I won't go into great detail on those. There are concerns raised about the portion of the question that relates to the requirements that would apply to individuals who do not vote in person. There are a number of concerns raised, including provisional balloting that may be required and the concern that the question does not refer to that. I won't go into a great deal of detail. You have a copy of the, I believe in your packets, the motion papers that were filed on behalf of the legislature. It's got a cover letter on it dated June 8th, and Winthrop and Weinstein letterhead. But if you move in, if you turn the pages there and take a look at some of the arguments presented in the motion to intervene, the attorneys for the House and Senate raise concerns about the legislative prerogative to submit constitutional amendments and the accompanying standard of review that requires that. The motion, simply because it's a motion to intervene, doesn't go into a great deal of detail there, but I did want to call your attention to this document, which has been filed requesting intervention status as an intervening party for the legislature. I don't think I have a great deal of additional points to make unless members have any questions.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one question I have, has the legislature ever taken this action of actually intervening as a party in a lawsuit? So we're becoming a party?
I believe there is.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Michael may have some fairly direct history on that.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the commission, to my knowledge, the legislature has never taken this exact action of intervening in a pre-existing lawsuit. The legislature has, as I suspect most of you know, filed amicus briefs in ongoing cases. It's initiated lawsuits in a couple of instances against the governor, and it's been defendants in lawsuits many times, but it's never, to my knowledge, there's never been an instance where the legislature as a body has moved to intervene in a lawsuit. The one little nuance that I would add to that is there was an instance when the Senate, not both bodies, but the Senate moved to intervene, and that arose in, if I recall right, in 1995 when the House sued Governor Arne Carlson because he had directed the Commissioner of Administration to take over House space in the Capitol. The House, in that instance, initiated a lawsuit against Governor Carlson, obtained a temporary restraining order stopping the action of the Commissioner of Administration. After that had occurred, I think the Senate then concluded that that could have an impact on their use of Capitol space, and so then they decided to intervene in that lawsuit before the motion for a preliminary injunction was heard. That's the closest analogy to this instance, but there's, to my, and I've been around here a long time, but not for the whole history of the legislature, so. But I don't know that there's an answer directly to Representative Thiessen's question. I don't believe that the legislature itself, jointly, the two houses, have ever intervened in an ongoing lawsuit.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And I'm not sure who, I know a brief has already been filed, and I get the timing issue. I'm not sure who can answer this question, but did we get, is this being paid for? Is this being done pro bono? Is the legislature going to be paying Winthrop and Weinstein to do this litigation?
Is there someone who would want to address that directly? Mr. Bottern.
Madam Chair, there is drafts of a letter of engagement have been exchanged with the Winthrop firm, and it's my understanding at this point that a flat fee arrangement has been prepared. The fee involved is $18,000 and includes the motion papers attendant to the motion to intervene and the brief and accompanying arguments. It's limited solely to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Thiessen?
Yeah, and just and that's being paid for from what source?
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, the LCC will be paying that those charges from its operating budgets or the carry-forward accounts. We have some salary savings due to the hiring freeze, and so we would use those savings.
Okay.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just curious if you could just provide a little Brief background, it's my understanding that the Attorney General's office will be acting as counsel on behalf of the Secretary of State's office in how this works, and I'm curious if there's been any discussions with the Attorney General's office and whether or not they were intending to represent the legislature's interest in their right to submit ballot questions, or a little background on how this moves forward.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, yes, it is correct that the Office of the Attorney General will represent the respondent, the named respondent in this case, Secretary of State Mark Ritchie. At the direction of the Speaker's office, I did call the Attorney General and talk to them and asked them if they would consider representing the legislature in this matter. They thought about it for a while and declined, saying, I forget the exact term, but they thought it would be a little bit, can't actually recall the exact words, but they felt that it would, you know, be a little bit unusual for them to represent both the Secretary of State and the legislature in this, and in fact suggested that we might, you know, consider, you know, on our own either filing, I think they directly suggested the possibility of us filing an amicus brief. So I just think they're uncomfortable representing two entities, and we've encountered this in the past where when they were representing an executive branch official, they may not wish to represent the legislature, even though it's not clear that, you know, the interests necessarily diverge. It's hard for them to predict how that will go. So I fully understand, you know, that decision.
And Representative Holper.
If I might, in recent history, and I don't remember all the particulars, but I remember being a member of the minority party when the majority party used House counsel for a lawsuit, which the net effect was, because of the House research being used in that manner, we as minority members that may not have agreed with the position that the House counsel was taking because of the direction from the Speaker's office, we were not able to get information out of House research. So would we avoid that situation here by hiring outside counsel? In other words, would all House members be able to retain their right to get information on either side of this issue, if you will, by virtue of the fact that the House counsel was not being used for this purpose?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, I assume that what you're referring to is the amicus brief that we filed on behalf of the House in the 2009 unallotment. And yes, that created an uncomfortable situation for us when the minority requested that we prepare arguments in support of their view of the, you know, the legal case in that instance. And because of our duties under the professional rules of the Code of Professional Responsibility, we had to decline to do that. In this instance, I think that House research attorneys would be available to any member who wanted them to prepare, you know, or analyze what, you know, appropriate arguments would be on either side of this case, since we're not going to be, you know, directly involved in that. The outside firm will be involved in preparing the briefs.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in this statutory proceeding, errors and omissions, is it just briefing, or is there a chance for factual development in the case for discovery and those kind of things? If, you know, for instance, as to legislative intent and those types of issues.
Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, the statute doesn't specifically reference discovery. It appears to be limited to questions of law. What I would call your attention to in the scheduling order is that item 3, or paragraph 3 on page 2, provides a deadline for any party who contends there is an issue of fact or facts material to the case. That deadline has passed already, and to my knowledge, no party has sought relief that way.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand there was this conversation with the Attorney General's office. What is the statutory charge for the Secretary of State and the Attorney General in terms of defending defending against this type of a claim? I'm assuming their legal charge and authority is to actually defend the language of the statute and or the language of the ballot question for the because that on the on behalf of the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Botter.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I'm not sure that there's anything in statutes directly describing the duties for the Secretary of State. It's clear enough, and I'm looking, I have the section of law, section 8.06 of the Minnesota statute sets out the Attorney General's duty to represent state officers and makes it clear that the Attorney General shall act as the attorney for all state officers. The Attorney General also has, there's, I think, a body of case law and some other guidance that suggests the Attorney General has a duty to represent the interests of the state in addition to those officers. So there may be some room for interpretation there in terms of a broader duty to defend the ballot question.
Right. So,
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, meaning that we don't have any expectation that the Attorney General is going to going to do anything other than what the statute would call out, which is to defend the language of the ballot question that the legislature passed and to make the arguments, you know, whether they're good arguments or not, in favor of that as an advocate for the state of Minnesota, because the state in this case, the party, is the one that has the ballot question on the draft of the ballot question. So I'm assuming they would defend that ballot question just like any other party would on behalf of the state.
Mr. Botter.
Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I think the what I would add to that is so far the Attorney General has really been silent about the intention to, you know, as to what kind of position the Attorney General will take. Under the scheduling order, we won't hear anything from the Attorney General, I think, until June 25th when the briefs are due. So there's no indication at this point, really one way or the other, from that office.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a good lawyer's answer, Tom. All right.
Representative okay. Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Botter, and I just want to make sure that I'm understanding correctly what you're saying. You're saying clearly that the Attorney General has a responsibility of representing the state's officers, and I take it the officers do not include legislators. Is that correct? And also that to represent the state, is it? Are you saying that there's no clear statute or practice or whatever that the Attorney General would need to represent the legislature as a whole?
Mr. Botter?
Madam Chair and Representative Lenning, I think I can say with some certainty there's nothing that clearly requires there's no statute or other written guidance that would require the Attorney General to represent the legislature. That area is somewhat ambiguous, exactly where and when that duty begins. Mr. Michael, I'm sure, has something to add to that.
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, the only couple of points that I would add to that is that the Constitution puts the Attorney General into the executive branch, and so the Attorney General is an executive branch official. And, of course, the Constitution also provides for explicit separation of powers. In our discussions with the Attorney General in the past practices, generally been that on a case-by-case basis, the Attorney General will decide whether it's appropriate for the Attorney General to represent the legislature if the legislature requests that representation because of the separation of powers doctrine under the Constitution. And my interpretation of the statute that Tom has referred to is that it really, when it talks about officials, that's really implicitly referring to executive branch officials. And that's why it's, you know, a case-by-case question and why And the Attorney General routinely does represent the legislature on a discretionary basis. So, for example, recently, right now, for example, the House is involved in litigation that the Attorney General is representing us. And there was a challenge to the increase in the per diem back in 2008 that the Attorney General represented the legislature on. And in all of those instances, it's done on a case-by-case basis as to our requesting it and their deciding whether they consider it to be appropriate. That in general, they've been very good in being willing to represent, at least on the House side, when we've asked them, when they don't perceive that there's any possibility of a branch conflict.
Well, Madam Chair, given that explanation, I think it's very clear that the action we have before us here is the course that we need to take by getting an independent representation here on this matter.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And I'm just looking at the resolution, and it's saying that the position of the legislature is taking is that the legislature has the exclusive constitutional authority to provide for the form and manner of submitting proposed constitutional amendments. So am I correct in stating that the position that the legislature is taking by passing this resolution and moving forward with this litigation is that whatever we choose to put and define as the constitutional question, whether in this case or in the future, our position is going to be that the courts don't have any right to look at that and apply the tests that they've applied in past cases. And I'm looking particularly at that word exclusive constitutional authority, because I want to make sure that I understand exactly the position that the legislature is going to be taking in this litigation.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I guess I would not read that word exclusive that strictly, because we all recognize there is a body of case law, it's dicta out there, that where the court has said that it will, and I think everybody recognizes that the unique role of the judiciary is to interpret and apply the law. And in this instance, what their dicta has said is that if I think the term they've used in the past in the early turn of the century cases, which was reaffirmed in 2006, if the question is palpably misleading or something to that effect, that then the court will has a role to take action, and I assume that we will be arguing consistently with that, with the previous teachings of the court. And so I wouldn't read that exclusive. I think it's exclusive in the sense that the Constitution dedicates this role to the legislature, and the executive branch and the judiciary particularly the executive branch doesn't have a role in this. So I don't think it would be arguing that if it's totally misleading that the court doesn't have a role in deciding this. But obviously the briefs haven't been written, and that's going to be up to the lawyers.
Okay. And Madam
Representative
Chair.
Representative Thiessen.
So, I mean, I am concerned about that word exclusive, and it appears throughout the motion to intervene as well that it's the exclusive authority of the legislature to make these determinations. I guess I would ask the folks that actually engaged the lawyers, and I'm not even sure who that is. It's not clear to me who actually had these conversations with Winthrop and Weinstein. But maybe we can get some clarification from that person about what their understanding of this word exclusive is. I mean, is it going to be the position of the legislature that pretty much anything we put on the ballot? Because, quite honestly, and we talked about this during the passage of this legislation, which I would say Senator Senjum was not a bipartisan bill, notwithstanding your quotes to the press on that. But that's maybe an aside. That this is going to actually be a situation where we're going to actually argue within the context of the previous law that there is a place for the courts to come in and actually assess whether the question is misleading, and that if it is determined to be misleading, that that is outside of the legislature's prerogative to put misleading ballot questions on the ballot. And I'm actually looking to the legislators, because we're the ones, you're the ones that actually, you know, I'm assuming engaged the lawyers with this. I'd like to get your understanding and intent of what you've directed the lawyers to do.
Is there anyone who did want to address that?
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
I didn't have, you know, these conversations with the lawyers, but as I read it, I think Mr. Michaels suggested this, that we're talking about exclusive constitutional authority to provide for the form and the manner of submitting proposed constitutional amendments. That, in my view, is the prerogative of the legislature. That is the duty of the legislature if it chooses to exercise it.
And Madam Chair, but Senator Senator, not the duty, not it's not our prerogative to put things that don't actually legitimately describe what the actual constitutional amendment says in the ballot question. I'm assuming that's not the position we're going to be taking. So that if it is determined to be misleading, then you wouldn't be making the argument that that's what the ballot question should be.
Senator Senjum?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I know that a lot of work is that went into this question about what the amendment language should be, and I'm convinced personally that all this was considered and the work of the legislature through not only the committee process but the authorship process was such that this was considered, and those people did, and the legislature did the best job they could in putting forth an amendment that they believed was properly worded.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. Well, Representative Thiessen, I think we see time and again the judicial branch makes their own decisions under their own authority, and I don't think whether or not the word exclusive being on this document or not is going to change what they view as their role, and as expressed by Mr. Michael, if they find that it's whatever term, misleading or whatever. I mean, there's not. I don't see anything in approving this document that changes any authority of the court.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Thiessen.
My argument is that I don't think we can change the authority of the court. My question is, and we're doing something we've never done before, which is actually intervene in a lawsuit. The legislature has never done this. So we're taking an unprecedented step today as we sit here, again, to do what seems to be the highest priority of the Republican leadership, which is these constitutional amendments that were passed, the main thing that this majority got done in 2 years. And we're taking an unprecedented step to intervene. First time we've ever done it. We're going to be expending state tax dollars on this to pursue this litigation, you know, in addition to the tax dollars we're spending on other lawsuits. And I want to make sure that the argument that we're going to be making is not, it's the argument to be made that this is not misleading, that the ballot question is not misleading, as opposed to making the argument that it's exclusively our decision and the courts can't even look into it. Because that's an argument, he said it was dicta, that someone could make. And before we spend $18,000 and before we take this unprecedented step, I want to understand exactly what the legislature's argument is going to be. Because I don't think, I do think it was within the court's jurisdiction to look at whether something is misleading or not. And this is not saying that. When you say exclusive constitutional authority, this could be saying that we're going to be making a very different argument than that.
Further discussion on the resolution. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen. We do have exclusive constitutional authority to provide the form and manner subject to the court's palpable evasion. And not being a lawyer, I don't know exactly how palpable evasion is described and used by the courts. But your argument gives weight to the idea that we do have standing, because the legislature took a very strong position, and now we're subjecting the legislature's strong position to court review. And so I would think, as a legislator who intends to go further in his legislative career, you would want to support the idea that when the legislature takes a strong position, We do have an inherent right to stand before the court and affirm that position. And that is primarily the purpose of this hearing.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, could you please describe the similarities between this question and the question brought before the Secretary of State in 2006, I believe it was Secretary of State at that time, Kiffmeyer, which was a similar a similar question. And I believe it was the same question that Representative Thiessen brings up, is whose job it is to put this forward. And do you recall what the court said as regard to the question that Representative Thiessen brought up?
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, yes, the 2006, when in 2005, the legislature submitted a constitutional amendment that dedicated and was adopted by the voters, that dedicated the motor vehicle sales tax to transportation purposes, and a lawsuit very similar to this was filed by a group of citizens challenging the question, asserting that the question did not accurately, was confusing, and didn't reflect the underlying amendment. And the court rejected that challenge and essentially used the language that said that the legislature, you know, it's the legislative prerogative to set the, to determine the question, and that there's, it's left, in the words of the court, it's left to the judgment and discretion of the legislature, subject only to the implied limitation that they, meaning the question must not be unreasonable and misleading as to be a palpable evasion of the constitutional requirement to submit the law to a popular vote. So that essentially what the court was saying was that the legislature has wide latitude in determining how to phrase the question so long as it's not palpably evasive and of the requirement to submit the vote. Submit it to the voters. And there have been other cases like this back around the turn of the century that have been, you know, similarly decided. And this the standard that it's citing is, well, you know, dates back to those earlier turn of the century cases.
Representative Dean.
And Mr. Michael, and so that there would be nothing different from what we're doing now than what they had done in 2006, we're not proposing changing the contours of that at all in terms of the court's ability to, if it was, I think, the word palpably evasive.
Right.
So we're not doing anything differently now or proposing that a different standard be enacted at this time.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, as I said before, I would expect that the arguments that will be made within the context of that case law, and I can't say how they're going to write the brief, obviously.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Thiessen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess, you know, that's not what the resolution says. That's not what the briefs are saying. And we'll have to see, I guess. I'm assuming this is going to pass today. But we'll have to see what the briefs are said. I hope that we don't make a different argument than the standard that the courts have already set up if this goes forward. You know, I'm going to – the bottom line is this this constitutional amendment, if it does become law, is going to cost the taxpayers of Minnesota tens of millions of dollars. And now we're taking an unprecedented step in intervening in litigation, something the legislature's never has done before. We're going to be paying more tax dollars to defend what we should have done right the first time, and we didn't do it right the first time. And so I'm going to, you know, be voting against it because I don't think we should be spending more taxpayers' dollars on the legislature to be talking about, you know, kind of this obsession with constitutional amendments. Taxpayer dollars to continue to pursue these constitutional amendments doesn't make sense to me. I don't think it's a good use of taxpayer dollars, and to take an unprecedented step doesn't make sense, so I'll be voting no.
And possibly Mr. Michael or Mr. Bodner could help me out with this. Representative Thiessen mentioned unprecedented and never done before. And I just want to make sure that I understand the cases in the past. My understanding is the 91 redistricting suit, we actually, the legislature actually initiated that, and so we were a party to that. So this isn't completely unprecedented, and maybe someone could just clear that up so I completely understand, because there's some big, there's some words being thrown around that I don't think are expressed completely accurately how where we stand. Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, just to clarify, the legislature has, as you indicated, initiated lawsuits. What it, this is different in the narrow sense that there's an ongoing lawsuit with other parties that the legislature is moving to join, to intervene in, as the technical legal term under Rule 24 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. That's what the legislature has not done before. It has initiated lawsuits.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I wanted to address some of the hyperbole that has been flying across the table about tens of millions of dollars. Those same accusations were made in other states where the voter ID laws were implemented, and the reality of the performance of the law was a de minimis impact on the budget. So before we leave tens of millions of dollars on the record here, I would like to specifically countervene that point.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Zellers renews his motion that the resolution relating to legal counsel be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no.
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 The motion is adopted. Moving on to, I believe, the only thing we have left is other business that may come before the committee. Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. Representative Holberg moves to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. We are adjourned.